question about the
talk show. Recorded live.
Guys, I'm going to call back in because it sounds funky. With somebody talking, let me see if it's sounding funky when you talk.
It doesn't sound funky on our.
Yeah, something's wrong. I'm going to call back in and start the call again.
Okay, we'll try to behave.
Okay, don't hang up. I'm thinking I'm the only one that needs to call back.
Okay. Let's all leave now.
Wendy, is your friend the one who posted the question for her about the access their partner contacting them?
No. That was the one that was on the forum that she couldn't get on, and you just go here and here. And then I went and looked, and it's like, oh, okay, it's because there's no add comment thing.
Mm-hmm. I replied back to her and said they definitely should change their number because they get crazy, because she was the same way. He changed everything, his work email address, his cell phone numbers.
Mm-hmm.
They had to close everything. She was so persistent.
But Kathy is on the call, Wendy.
Oh, there's Kathy. There she is.
But I'm muting myself.
But she's muting. Kathy is my friend that lives in Reading, that was in Harboring Hope with me.
Oh. Hmm? You guys live, is that close to you?
She lives in Northern California. We live up by Seattle. But our son is at Berkeley, so when we go down, we went to visit her a little bit. And I had met her when she flew up to go see her son.
How long is the Harboring Hope program? Is it the same amount of time as the 911?
I can't remember how many weeks. Is it 13 weeks, 14?
I thought it was 12.
Well, I don't know. See, Denny probably could tell better. He's one who had to do it.
Did her Harboring Hope group help you? I've heard it helps a lot.
Oh, yes. It helped Denny, too.
Yeah, it did.
Okay. Now it's working live. Sorry, guys. So I could hear y'all having a good time in the background. They're all chatting.
We were.
Is it recording still?
No.
We're still recording. Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
But that didn't get recorded, though, so don't worry.
Okay.
That part did not get recorded.
I didn't.
Let's see. Where is that? I've lost this. Hang on just one. I am not doing good here today. Mm-hmm. Keep messing up. There we go. Okie dokie. There. Now I'm back on the right page. Okay, so for the first question today, taking it personal. How can I stop taking it personal? If my husband has a sexual addiction that led him into an affair for 3 years, how can I really understand that it's not that he didn't love me and didn't want to betray me for her? The only answer I can give to that one, and I'm afraid that it may not be really satisfactory to you, but it's the fact that it wasn't a choice. Typically, it's not a choice that someone is trying to make between one person or another, depending on, especially with sexual addiction. It's not a choosing. Typically, there's very little thought put into one's mate at that point. The reality is they're trying not to think of their mate. So, and it's not that they really want to, it's almost like they want, want to scratch the itch that comes with the sexual addiction. The person that's active in their addiction is just kind of void of love for everyone. And in one level, all they're looking for is getting their own selfish gratification. And I mean, to even say that there's love being exhibited to any party at that point when someone's active, I think, was a little bit misguided. It's pretty sad when somebody's acting out in that sense. So, you know, that's why I would say I don't think that it's about loving one person or loving another person. I understand it would be really difficult, you know, to be betrayed like that. You know, I just know that he wasn't, you know, in that insanity, and that's why we call it insanity, the person doesn't really want to lose their marriage necessarily. They're compelled into something else, and that's what's happening. So I wish I had a better answer. I'm just terribly sorry that happened to you. And I can just tell you, if he didn't want to be with you, then most likely he would have left. But he really was confused and insane during that time period, and hopefully he's doing what's necessary to be healthy so he can actually learn how to be less self-centered and begin to move into what I would consider to be a real, genuine love, and that he's doing what's necessary to keep himself safe for you in the relationship. Here's one from Denny. How would you explain addiction and its associated behavior, especially sexual addiction, to a betrayed spouse who does not suffer from this and doesn't understand how they could do these things and say they still love them? You know, the best analogy, Denny, that I've got, and it's the one I've been using lately, is just, yeah, and I'll use it again. I wish I had a better one, but it's the one of poison ivy. I have a normal state, and I also have the state when I've got my rash, because I've foolishly put myself in circumstances where ultimately, you know, my allergy to poison ivy is activated. And it's not that I don't have my normal state. I mean, the fact is I've got another itch now that I want to scratch, and I've just got to be incredibly important or incredibly careful not to place myself in circumstances where I break out in a way that or put myself in a place where I actually have a reaction, which creates a whole other issue for me to deal with. And I think it's just very difficult for someone who's not an addict to understand that. Because, you know, I can say all day long, it's not that you're helpless, it's just that you're powerless. And those two concepts, you know, the addict is not a victim. But they've got to be willing, I think, to have a tremendous amount of humility or humiliation to come to that point. Ultimately, they're going to do what it's going to take to get, you know, whole. And for the addict, in my mind, Denny, what it ultimately takes is you've got to give up your ego and your pride and accept what you're not. And until you can accept that you've got a really, really serious problem, you will always be a risk to your mate. And so when you say, that last part, to a betrayed spouse who does not suffer from this and does not understand how they could do these things and say they still love them. I mean, you know, it's unless you understand that whole aspect of, I think, what I call that rash that you want to really itch and the incredible compulsion that comes along with that. But again, you can explain that, but you can't say the person was helpless. And it was their pride and their ego and their self-centeredness that kept them from addressing it. And I just, you know that ultimately, if you don't begin to address that, if the addict doesn't begin to address that, you know, sorries and good intentions will never be enough to stop anything. My husband willingly suggested that he was going to change his email address for work, his cell phone number, and he asked me to change the passwords for all his chat and personal email accounts so he didn't have a chance to get any messages from her. Don't close the accounts. We found this doesn't work. They never shut them down. She's been very aggressive for 3 years. I just had disclosure April 1st, 2010. I would for sure change the numbers, email accounts, etc., and tell her you're putting in a police report that she's not allowed to show up at your house or place of work. Don't know if there's a particular question in that. I would agree that eventually you've got to set real. I mean, you've got to set the boundaries and let them know what's going to happen. And I think that I've certainly had people file restraining orders, and so there's nothing wrong with that. And I also think that changing numbers and email accounts, all of those things are good plans. They're not foolproof, and knowing what to do, I think whenever something – If they somehow do get a hold of the number again and how you're going to respond to that. And so I would go beyond just doing that as to what's going to happen if she does find out another number, somehow the new number or the new email account. Now, because if it's a work account, there may be ways ultimately for someone, and it may not be in your case, but in some cases for people to discover things anyway. And, again, what's going to be important at that point is the communication between the two of you, because the way you know that loyalty exists is the fact that, you know, your mate's willing to do what's necessary to protect your relationship, not protect the affair partner. Next. My husband's affair partner called and left a message on his cell phone last weekend. It's been 6 months of no contact. He didn't answer it and handed me the phone to listen to the message. This was good. He didn't even ask me what she said. My question is it useful to change his number? We'd already changed it and she found it, probably on the internet somehow. These days it seems there is no hiding anywhere. Also, she's really angry and pointed out how long he was in not contact staying with her. Should we worry about her showing up at our door and trying to take some kind of revenge? She did not threaten yet. You know, it sounds like you handled that really, really well. I think that goes back to the one I was just responding to. You can change it. Maybe that one I just answered before was in response to that. People can still get a hold of it. If she's not threatening, I would say a non-response is by far your best response. If you can always, or I think if you respond at one level, you kind of gratify their hostility by acting as if you've been gotten, and I think you're better off. Just ignoring it, and eventually if there's no secondary gain to their contacting and leaving bad emails or whatever, with no secondary gain, I think in the long run they eventually begin to shut down. So I would just say leave it and let, you know, hopefully that person will get reattached some other place in some other situation. Just make sure that there's always that ongoing communication between the two of you, that you know that course of action, such as you listening to the message. Another thing that has worked in the past that I've had, if there ever is threatening, that you actually have an attorney respond on behalf of both of you, and oftentimes a letter from an attorney is an effective way, or if it's a threat, even from law enforcement. So not even for the two of you respond, but to have a third party respond that has some type of authority and actually is setting the boundary. So that's the other way to go, especially if she continues doing this. And if it's, of course, if it's threats, you can have law enforcement respond. If it's just continued contact, I would have an attorney respond and let them, to the full extent that they can, lay out why this person is going to stop this. Let's see. Intrusive thoughts. Yipper, this is a good one. Rick, could you talk about how to handle intrusive thoughts for both hurt and unfaithful spouses? What is the difference in the kinds of thoughts each have and what to do about them? For the hurt spouse, typically those intrusive thoughts can actually serve a lot of different purposes. Sometimes intrusive thoughts can actually be a sign of incomplete grieving. Sometimes intrusive thoughts, just initially at the point of discovery and for the first few months, are very, very natural. And I think that almost utilizing those thoughts as a way of helping facilitate the grieving process is an important piece. It's just the things that sometimes we look at, we get our mind around. It's just that if it's too painful, it's difficult oftentimes to get your mind around kind of what you're looking at. And I think having someone to process the intrusive thoughts with, there are several techniques that are really useful. Typically intrusive thoughts, I think to answer this part of the question, deal a lot for the hurt spouse with painful reminders or images or hurts of things in the past that kind of are just really painful parts of what has happened. And one of the ways you know that there's kind of an incompleted or uncompleted grief is if you can only think of the negative aspects of a person. So, you know, I think that, and that would be very normal at the first stage, but if you don't ever come to the place where you begin to think of also of the good memories and those losses, and if it's all the negative, but you're not also remembering good things and having a balance, then in the long run, you know, you'll just know that part of the pain, you're not, haven't quite worked through all of the pain aspect. And so intrusive thoughts at one level serve a bit as a barometer, I think, for the hurt spouse about the grieving process. And hopefully if they go along, they should begin to diminish. If the intensity, the frequency of those thoughts don't diminish over time, then you know, one of the things you've got to begin to look at is, you know, have you been facing it? If you have been facing it, then there's always the possibility of PTSD, and then that's got to be dealt with. But usually it's just a lot of those intrusive thoughts are past-oriented. Now, sometimes there are also future-oriented intrusive thoughts about a fear of the future. And a lot of healing comes when you begin to begin to look at this day and also be in the moment. So you've almost got to decide with the intrusive thoughts how to utilize them. There's a lot of material we could talk about on this, like a whole book. If you've gone through Harboring Hope, if you've gone through EMS or 911 marriage, there's some suggestions. We're continually writing stuff on how to deal with intrusive thoughts for the hurt spouse. For the unfaithful spouse, intrusive thoughts oftentimes deal with regrets and can also deal with, which induce a lot of guilt, toxic shame. They can also be future-oriented, impulses to act out. For the unfaithful spouse, I think in terms of managing thought life, obviously there's a place of looking at and learning from what you did, almost using that guilt or that conviction is almost in a grace-oriented way to see kind of where you went wrong, learning experience. But then it's also very much about, I think, for the unfaithful spouse, whether it's impulses to act out again in the future or shame or guilt in the past, very much, I think, for the unfaithful spouse, it's about learning to live in the moment, not worrying about tomorrow, knowing that there's enough grace to get through this day. I think dwelling too much in the past for the unfaithful spouse or dwelling way too much in the future, both of those really will impede their ability to heal. And I think being very careful, once you've kind of done your work with your own inventory and you've looked at it and you've shared it and you're aware of it, then you just keep it on a daily basis and you just keep watching, you know, what's going on within you, monitor that part of you, be with other people that you can talk about temptations, try not to live too much in the future and try not to live too much in the past. Try not to be ego-centered, but instead, you know, ultimately begin to search and see maybe what God has for you in all of this. And it really is about learning how to walk each day in wholeness. And the intrusive thoughts are the pieces that ultimately try to drag me out of what I need to be about today, which is caring about other people and considering other people. And the problem with those intrusive thoughts for the unfaithful spouse is they kind of get them back to making it all about them. So I think that they need to be very careful about handling those thoughts and moving forward. Forward in the sense of just living the way they need to be living. I mean, people fail. The unfaithful spouse fails, but my issue is always now what? Once you fall, what are you going to do? And those intrusive thoughts that keep you living back at the point of the fall are going to impede you from getting about and doing what you need to be doing in the moment to help other people heal. And they just make it all about you at that point. So they've got to deal with those intrusive thoughts. Let's see. Can you explain why sex addiction does not just go away? You know, it maybe it's a little bit like food addiction. I mean, it's one thing if what you're trying to do with alcohol or cocaine, I mean, I don't have to drink beer or I don't have to drink alcohol in order to be a whole person. And in that sense, you know, I don't know that it ever goes away for them too. I mean, I think the propensity in our own brokenness to run to the kind of the empty things of life, the addictions of life that we think ultimately will fill that void in our soul. You know, I think that I can at least avoid something, and as I go along in life, it probably seems that it may somewhat seem less appealing to me. And I think when you deal with sex or food or some of the other behaviors that are really about maybe other aspects that are very healthy, it's more of a distortion of something that's a healthy aspect of our life. It's just important to always think about it the right way, because I certainly intend to continue to be intimate with my wife. But because I'm still being intimate with my wife, because if I'm a food addict, I'm still eating, it's very easy to fall back into a bad way of thinking. And that's why I think a lot of times sexual addiction is more difficult. Another aspect of the sexual addiction that makes it more difficult is the ease of access. simply, for most people, all you have to do is begin to imagine a situation, and truly you can create much of the same high simply in your mind without ever taking any type of substance. So that makes it more difficult in the sense that it's about the easiest one to access. It's only one thought away. Even for food, you have to go to the refrigerator. For beer or cocaine, there's something you've got to do. For even most behaviors like gambling, at least you've got to show up at the casino. But for sex addiction, you just have to see something and immediately think, and or just have a thought, period, or have a dream, and you're there. So I think that's another reason that it can be a bit more difficult. So next question. Only God knows. You know, one of the things we teach is that, and I didn't write this. I don't know initially where this story came from. I've heard several people use it, but I don't know who the initial author is, so I just don't want to take credit, and I would give credit if I knew where credit was due. But in life and in recovery, to me, one of the worst things we can do, even with our anger, is we judge things. We think we know how things ought to be. And in that piece of judging it, we actually put ourselves in really difficult binds, I guess. So as I kind of I always tell a story about, I need to start back a little bit earlier, though. So let me talk a few minutes about this. Need a drink here. Oftentimes in life, we make a decision or we make a judgment thinking that we know ultimately how things ought to be. How things need to turn out. It's almost like when we begin to make that judgment, we're saying that ultimately we know what's best. And I'm of the opinion that frequently I'm not bright enough to really know what needs to happen. In fact, I'm of the opinion that God probably knows far better than me what's going to be the best course of action. But in my own arrogance and in my own self-centeredness, I usually think in any given situation, I know exactly how things ought to turn out. Well, the problem is once I make that determination of how things ought to turn out, what I will do then is bring all of my efforts to bear to make sure things turn out the way that I think they ought to turn out, which means that once I pass a judgment about how things ought to be, then immediately I surrender my peace. You know, I surrender... I kind of now handcuff myself to an outcome that I really don't have any control over. So if you have a kid that's using drugs and you say, oh, that's really bad, and so you confront your kid, but let's say you know that what your kid ought to do at that point, you know the outcome and your kid needs to start hanging with this group and do this or do that, you know, you can try as you may and try as you might to make your child do what you had determined in your judgment, what you think would be best, but you have very little power as a parent to make that occur. If you decide that your boss ought to do this and this is how things ought to be, you know, you can try as you may, try as you might, but you have very little control over your boss. And ultimately, what you're going to discover in most situations is you can't determine the outcome. So the way I try to live life as much as possible is I like this story that I was going to tell, which is about a man in India whose horse runs off. And all the villagers said, that's really bad. It's harvest time. You can't get your crops in. I mean, what are you going to do, you know? And the old man said, well, you know, actually, I don't know what's good or bad. You know, only God knows. I'm just trusting God's going to give me what I need today. But the next day, when his horse came back and it picked up two mares in the mountains, all the villagers said, that's a really good thing. Your horse ran off, and they've got four horses. And the old man said, you know, I don't know what's good or bad. Only God knows. But then the next day, what actually happened was his son tripped and fell and broke his leg. And all the villagers are saying, man, that's really bad. Now you still can't get your crops in because your son broke his leg. And the old man said, well, you know, actually, I don't know what's good or bad. Only God knows. But then the next day, you know, an army came through that village and drafted all the young men of fighting age, and they were all killed in the battle that afternoon. And all the villagers said, man, it's a good thing that, you know, your son broke his leg or he'd be dead now. And the old man said, you know, I don't know what's good or bad. Only God knows. And I've just found in the recovery process, if I quit thinking I know how it needs to turn out, and instead, you know, I just sit there and keep going, God, I don't know what's good or bad. Only you know. I'm just trusting that there's, you know, a power greater than me. There's a God bigger than me who actually does know how it ought to turn out. I try to let God define the circumstance where I go, you know, God could be doing something here. This could be a God thing. This isn't necessarily a bad thing. I just don't know what's going to happen. So I try to leave, you know, my hands very open to potential outcomes. And I find when I do that, that it's a huge help not to judge it. And the thing that I believe that is God's greatest miracle is he always takes the worst thing that ever happened and he somehow makes it the best. And so if I quit striving and trying to make it happen, because I think if I try to make it happen, usually all God is going to let me discover is that I'm not God and I find out that I can't do it. And then all of my best plans don't work anyway. That it really has much more to do with faith and living in the moment and not judging it, you know, letting God work it out his way and letting go of my way. And that is a part of surrender, just allowing things to naturally begin to come to me. And it's so much of, I think, the recovery process is about the letting go. How do I, you know, quit striving to make it occur? I'm trying to find something here I can read you guys. I may have taken it out, so I might not have it here. Yep, I don't have it. Well, I'm going to read the other. I was going to have something else to read, but I won't today. And I can read it next time. But let go. And maybe that's where that not judging comes a long way to at least allowing us to stay focused on the right things. Because, again, trying to do it in my flesh, as I always say, the best of the flesh is the worst of the flesh. Me trying to be good only brings me into the circumstance where I get to prove that I can't, that I really am powerless. And the quicker I learn that lesson and to begin to say, I really don't know, only God knows, the quicker I get to the place where I think I can begin to heal. Another question, support groups. Do you recommend 12-step support groups for spouses of sex addicts, and which ones in particular? You know, I probably with I hate to say this, but to me it's a bit of a caveat. I've had people use Essanon very successfully. I've had people use Al-Anon for sexual addiction very successfully. A lot of times we'll even lean maybe a bit more toward Al-Anon than even Essanon. But my concern sometimes with any of the support groups for spouses of sex addicts, there is so much relational pain. Even more, I think, and someone can correct me here and say that I don't understand, but maybe even more so than with alcohol. Alcohol is awful, and drug addiction is awful. The sexual addiction, I think, though, creates even more of what I call that attachment wound, that attachment distress, and there's much more disorientation as a result of that. And I think the intensity of the pain created by that attachment wound that occurs when there's infidelity creates a tendency on many people's parts to make, in those meetings, to make the spouse the focus, and what do you do to manage the spouse or manage the pain, you know, or get the spouse, or to get the spouse to be a certain way to manage the pain, rather than focusing on your own inventory. And so when I've had the hurt spouse groups that are focused on managing their mate, I found them to be very unhelpful. And so it's the health of the group to me. If they're really focused on how do I surrender and accept what's coming into my life, and how do I stay focused on my own inventory, and how do I acknowledge, you know, my own powerlessness and stay focused on how I'm impacting other people and about my own defects of character and stay focused on my own inventory. As long as that's the focus, I find those groups to be amazingly helpful. But when those groups begin to be about trying to manage the unfaithful spouse, then to me they're going completely counter to the whole piece of surrender and to the whole piece of acceptance, the whole piece of faith in God. And at that point, I think they become very destructive. So I think God can use whatever group he wants to use. It's just very important that in that process you make sure you find a group that is focused on literally how do you look at your own powerlessness and life's unmanageability. How do you begin to accept your circumstance and what you can't do and what you can't control? And then how do you get on to surrendering to God and letting God begin to take over? And then how do you begin to focus on your own inventory, your own defects of character? How do you begin to look at what you've done to other people and what you're doing to other people? How do you keep growing in your own conscious awareness of God and learn how to pray? How do you begin to help others? And so I think that really depends a little bit not on the type of group, but the health of the group. So I would make that my one caveat about that. And that looks like that's the end of our questions for the day. So I want to thank everybody for, certainly everybody for calling in or writing in. And I guess we have a 911 call. I haven't decided if we're doing it this week or not. We have EMS this week, so that may get postponed till the following week. Be sure to get your questions in for next week, and I hope everybody does have a good week. Be sure to keep us in your prayers and your thoughts this weekend for those that are coming to the EMS weekend. So I'll talk to you guys next Monday. Thank you.